It's October 13th, 2008, an unusually warm day in Washington, D.C. Inside an ornate Treasury conference room, the temperature rises for another reason. Fear has overtaken the country. From the Federal Reserve to the Treasury, the halls of America's financial foundation has become an emergency triage unit, and the patient is the global economy. Capitalism, an economic system that took shape in the 16th century, is built on private property, competition, profit, and reinvestment into productive growth. Its innovation wasn't wealth itself, but what wealth funded: more goods, more jobs, more capacity for society. But over time, capital drifted towards spectacle over substance, luxury assets, political influence, and financial engineering, forms of wealth that signaled status rather than expand productivity. The system still rewarded profit, but not necessarily progress. Now, on one side of a long mahogany table sit the nation's top financial minds: Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson, flanked by Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke, FDIC Chair Sheila Bair, New York Fed President Timothy Geithner, and Comptroller of the Currency John Dugan. Their challenge: how far will they go to save capitalism from itself? Bernanke, a scholar of the Great Depression, is likely recalling a speech he gave in 2002 honoring Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz. He closed with a remarkable admission, quote, "Regarding the Great Depression, you're right. We did it. We're very sorry. But thanks to you, we won't do it again," end quote. Friedman had long argued that the Federal Reserve's tight monetary policy in the late 1920s turned a downturn into catastrophe. Monetarism asserted that persistent inflation and deflation are driven by the money supply, and that central banks should maintain steady monetary growth to stabilize prices. Friedman and Schwartz challenged the dominant Keynesian view that the Depression was a failure of demand requiring fiscal stimulus. They believed the Fed simply failed to keep banks liquid during panic, a government failure, not a market failure. But that worldview carried a deeper implication: trust markets, distrust government. Let prosperity flow from boardrooms downward. Yet history showed something else. Before the Fed, financial panics were constant. After the deregulatory wave of the 1980s, corporations optimized for profit without obligation to raise wages or strengthen communities. Growth concentrated at the top. The trickle-down rarely reached workers. When the bottom is hollowed out long enough, collapse eventually follows. By fall 2008, Bernanke, usually calm, soft-spoken, was exhausted. The markets were in free fall. A few weeks earlier, he delivered an extraordinary warning to congressional leaders.
"Despite the efforts of the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and other agencies, global financial markets remain under extraordinary stress. Action by the Congress is urgently required to stabilize the situation and avert what otherwise could be very serious consequences for our financial markets and for our economy. In this regard, the Federal Reserve supports the Treasury's proposal to buy illiquid assets from financial institutions. Purchasing impaired assets will create liquidity and promote price discovery in the markets for these assets, while reducing investor uncertainty about the current value and prospects of financial institutions. More generally, removing these assets from institutions' balance sheets will help to restore confidence in our financial markets and enable banks and other institutions to raise capital and to expand credit to support economic growth."
Congress passed the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, bailout on October 3rd, originally intended to buy toxic mortgage assets. But as panic worsened, Paulson and Bernanke concluded that buying assets was too slow. Something more drastic was required. On that fateful day of October 13th, 2008, just 3 weeks before the presidential election, Paulson summoned the CEOs of the 9 largest U.S. banks to the Treasury. The meeting was deliberately secretive. Even the CEOs didn't know why they were being called. Emails flew back and forth that morning, frantically trying to figure out if executives were actually necessary. Paulson demanded that they all appear in person, no deputies allowed, a sign of the gravity. Present were the most powerful figures on Wall Street: Jamie Dimon, Lloyd Blankfein, John Mack, Ken Lewis, Vikram Pandit, and others. They sat, uneasy, waiting. Paulson got straight to the point. The government would not buy troubled assets. Instead, each bank represented would have to accept direct capital injections, preferred equity stakes purchased by the Treasury, and every CEO in the room would participate. It was not optional. Agreements were placed on the table in front of each executive. Paulson's private talking points, later revealed through the Freedom of Information Act, included a blunt warning. Quote, "If a capital infusion is not appealing, be aware your regulator will require it in any circumstance." End quote. The message, sign or risk being marked as failing. Some executives resisted, particularly Richard Kovacevich of Wells Fargo.
Well, I think it was one of the worst economic decisions in the history of the United States. Everybody was well-intentioned, but the proposition that Hank put before us was that if we took this money, the confidence in the industry would go up. And I was arguing that day until I was told to be quiet, is the opposite would happen. And let's just look at the facts. Shortly after TARP, the stock market fell by 40%, and the banking industry stocks fell by 80%. So how can anyone say that TARP increased the confidence level of an industry when its stock market valuation fell by 80%? I think it caused the crisis to get much greater than it would have been if it would have been handled differently. And I think as we look back, we could have handled it differently. And I think the facts support that handling the crisis differently would have made the crisis less severe than it actually was.
But Paulson and Bernanke feared that if only weak banks accepted capital, markets would target them and deepen the panic. So all 9 banks were required to join to avoid stigma. The conditions were minimal. There were no requirements to increase lending or help homeowners. The goal was speed and unity, not oversight. Each CEO scribbled his bank's assigned amount, $25 billion each for JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, $10 billion for Goldman and Morgan Stanley, smaller amounts for the rest. In exchange, the government received preferred stock and warrants, partial nationalization on highly favorable terms to the banks. By 6:25 p.m., a Treasury aide emailed, quote, "We now have 9 out of 9. The deal was done. The next day, the Dow soared 936 points, the largest one-day point gain in history at the time. Markets exhaled. The immediate collapse was averted, but outside Wall Street, the suffering deepened.
As you know, in concert with the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, we took a number of actions to bolster confidence in the banking system. These included temporarily increasing deposit insurance coverage and providing guarantees to new senior unsecured debt issued by banks, thrifts, and holding companies. The purpose of all these programs is to increase bank lending and minimize the impact of deleveraging on the American economy. As a result of these efforts, the financial system is now more stable and interest rate spreads have narrowed substantially. However, credit remains tight and a serious threat to the economic outlook. Regulators will be watching to make sure these emergency resources are mainly used for their intended purpose, responsible lending to consumers and businesses. In the meantime, we remain focused on the borrower side of the equation. Everyone agrees that more needs to be done for homeowners. We need to prevent unnecessary foreclosures, and we need to modify loans at a much faster pace.
That was FDIC's Sheila Bair in a congressional hearing in October 2008. But most Americans didn't own stock. The financial system was abstract. The crisis was not.
John Taylor of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition says a record number of home foreclosures.
People in foreclosure or heading to foreclosure, which continue to be record numbers. And in April, we had 400,000 families facing foreclosure, filing foreclosure.
The housing crisis and the Great Recession that immediately followed it was a huge jump in the number of foreclosures in cities and regions around the country.
Up again, a whopping 81% from 2007 to 2008. More than 2.3 million American homeowners faced foreclosure proceedings last year.
It's one of a growing number of Americans who could face home foreclosure in the coming months.
The only thing you can do is just keep hope and just keep believing that something will resolve and you'll be able to stay where you're living.
Homes lost, jobs lost, life savings erased. 5 million families would ultimately lose their homes. 9 million jobs vanished. Treasury's $700 billion rescue stabilized banks, but only a fraction reached homeowners. Lending stayed tight. Many banks hoarded capital to protect themselves. Public anger exploded as headlines revealed banks paying bonuses while families were being evicted. President Bush went on television to defend the bailout.
We analyzed the situation very carefully. And the American people must understand that this carefully structured plan is aimed at helping you. If I'd have thought this situation would have been contained only to Wall Street, we'd have had a different response. But in our judgment, had we not acted decisively at the time we did, the credit crunch, the inability for banks in your communities to loan to your businesses would have affected the working people and the small businesses of America. And that's unacceptable to me and unacceptable to this cabinet.
But the pain spread anyway. By December, unemployment was soaring. Credit was frozen, retirement accounts had evaporated, and the Dow had lost half its value. They weren't talking about a market correction anymore. They were talking about collapse. The Federal Reserve, the government's lender of last resort, responded with unprecedented measures. 0% interest rates, hundreds of billions in emergency lending, massive asset purchases, money created out of thin air. The rescue would soon exceed the total cost of every war the United States had ever fought. Homeowner relief was weaker. The 2009 Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP, aimed to modify mortgages but proved slow and inconsistent. Participation was voluntary, guidelines were loosely enforced, and servicers routinely lost paperwork or foreclosed mid-review. Fewer than 800,000 permanent modifications materialized, far short of the millions promised. Months later, Bernanke would tell 60 Minutes.
Of all the events and all the things we've done in the last 18 months, the single one that makes me the angriest, that gives me the most angst, is the intervention with AIG. Here was a company that made all kinds of unconscionable bets. Then when those bets went wrong, we had a situation where the failure of that company would have brought down the financial system.
You say it makes you angry. What do you mean by that?
It makes me angry. I slammed the phone more than a few times on discussing AIG. It's just absolutely, I understand why the American people are angry. It's absolutely unfair that taxpayer dollars are going to prop up a company that made these terrible bets that was operating out of the sight of regulators, but which we have no choice but to stabilize or else risk enormous impact, not just on the financial system, but on the whole U.S. economy.
By then, the damage was done and quite profound. Even as economists declared the recession over, low- and middle-income Americans had lost a massive share of their wealth. The rules of capitalism had been rewritten. The market would no longer follow the people. The people would be expected to follow the market. and in the years ahead, the institutions rescued in 2008 would grow larger, richer, and more powerful, while ordinary Americans would have to figure out how to recover on their own. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Built to Divide.
You're seeing Jared Kushner meeting with executives in the White House, and then sometime after those meetings, the companies that those executives work for, run, or help to run, are giving very sizable mortgages to his company.
We own them. And what does that mean? Every request from our office, every request of our clients, everything that we want, they're going to do. And not only that, they're going to think of things we can't think of to do.
In the last episode, we examined the 1990s and 2000s, the lead up to and impacts of NAFTA, the ripple effects from the dot-com bubble burst, how social identity helped sell a bipartisan crusade for ownership, how subprime lending surged, especially in communities long denied credit, how the machine of securitization spread risk until it became collapse, and how architects, planners, and investors reshaped cities. We followed the political theater from Jack Kemp's hope to Clinton's national home ownership strategy to Bush's ownership society and explored who actually owned the upside and who absorbed the fall. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. In this episode, we detail the mechanics of the collapse and pick up where that story left off, the moment when the decades of financial experimentation and political complacency collided, how the government's rescue of the financial elite deepened inequality, reshaped cities, and set the stage for a new kind of housing crisis, one defined by corporate landlords, stagnant wages, and policy capture. And we'll get into all of that after this break. Episode 7, Eat the Middle Class. Since the 1970s, wages for the average American worker have barely moved. Housing costs, meanwhile, have rocketed into another atmosphere. In 1970, the median home costs roughly 3 times the average annual income. Today, it's more than 7. Under the basic 30 to 50% affordability rule, most Americans are now priced out or pushed into chronic financial strain. In cities like San Francisco, teachers and nurses drive hours from the outskirts, unable to live in the communities they sustain. Meanwhile, tech workers earning 6 figures compete for condos not as places to live, but as assets to park capital in. This widening gap between stagnant wages and soaring assets is not a natural accident of the market. It is the predictable outcome of a corrupted system that rewards those who already hold capital and suppresses those who don't. The American middle class was built on home ownership, a foundation of stability, equity, and intergenerational wealth. But after the 2008 collapse, that foundation cracked. The very tool that once lifted families became out of reach for millions. When home prices began falling, the National Association of Realtors moved swiftly, framing the downturn not as a necessary correction after years of speculation, but as a national emergency. Their solution wasn't to fix structural failures, it was to revive demand. The result was the 2009 first-time homebuyer tax credit, an $8,000 incentive meant to ignite buying in a fragile market.
Today we come to you urgently. We need to act now.
This is Ron Phipps, first vice president of the National Association of Realtors.
First, we need the $8,000 first-time homebuyer tax credit extended and expanded. It is responsible for 350,000 to 400,000 additional sales this year. Each sale generates approximately $63,000 in economic activity. We appreciate the $10 billion cost, but the direct benefit of this is to Americans, and the multiplier effect cannot be ignored. We need this done now. The average closing takes 45 days. We are at threshold. If you do not act immediately, then sales will wane. We are writing offers literally in our office today that are contingent on closing by the 30th of November, or the sales agreement is null and void, meaning the transaction goes away. It will not happen, and that's what people qualify for the $8,000. Second, NAR urges you to make GSE and FA mortgage loan limits, the higher limit is permanent. They expire on the 31st of December. Actions required now. Finally, realtors believe that the federal government must continue to play a role in mortgage markets. The second market must meet two key goals. First, we need to ensure that the housing market works at all times, regardless of the economy. And second, we need to provide mortgages to all qualified homeowners for sustainable homeownership. It's been an American tradition for communities to work together and help people in need. When a barn burned, the neighbors would rebuild it. We are asking for you to work with us, not to build a barn, but to rather build homes, homes for American families. I cannot overstate the immediacy now. You need to act on the extension today. Now, now, now.
The credit came with income limits, phasing out around $75,000 for single filers and $150,000 for joint filers, later raised to $125,000 and $225,000. But those very limits ensured that the benefits flowed mostly to middle and upper middle income buyers, not to low income households, and certainly not to those locked out of credit access altogether. Studies later confirmed that many of those recipients would have purchased anyway, meaning the subsidy inflated demand without expanding true affordability. As housing expert Diane Randall, former executive director of Partnership for Strong Communities, noted, rental relief, not ownership incentives, would have provided far more support to low-income families facing acute housing insecurity.
In fact, it demonstrated a shift that homelessness is growing at a faster rate in suburban and rural towns than in our urban centers. It's a finding that's consistent with many national studies. Has the current housing crisis increased the availability of rental housing for low-income households? Quite simply, that is not the case. The loss of regular income experienced by millions of Americans, whether through unemployment, reduction in work and benefits, or crises related to mortgage and foreclosure problems, pushes more lower-income households to look for affordable rentals. This pressure on the low-income rental market in turn drives up rents for these homes. The market for rental housing for low-income households is not the same as the market for those who have higher incomes and an increased ability to pay more. Although recent reports indicate that rental prices may be declining in some markets, these reports are coming primarily from large rental buildings that generally rent to higher income segments of the population. There also appears to be an influx of troubled properties in the rental market as homeowners try to rent property they can no longer afford themselves. Finally, I want to just say a couple words about the loss of the existing public housing. We estimate that there's been a loss of almost 200,000 units of public housing stock, which is mostly for low rental, and that there's an immediate need to preserve rental housing stock in the next decade.
Meanwhile, NAR fiercely opposed principal reduction programs, the one intervention that could have kept families in their homes. These programs reduce the amount a borrower owes. It would have cost banks a little money, but it would have prevented millions of foreclosures, which are costly for banks too. Critics warned it would drag down home values, yet economists showed the opposite was true. Principal reduction might shave a little off nearby appraisals, but foreclosure obliterates value. Distressed sales flood the market. Prices collapse. Neighborhoods hollow out. Principal reduction softens the fall. Foreclosure pulls the floor out entirely. The resistance wasn't about protecting communities. It was about protecting the asset values of lenders and investors. Multiple economists at the Fed, IMF, and leading universities later concluded that widespread principal reduction would have sped up the housing recovery and the broader economy. The message couldn't have been clearer. Protect home values, not homeowners. And into that gap stepped a new kind of buyer, investors. By late 2009, the landscape had shifted. Housing stock was available. Many lower middle income families were trapped in underwater mortgages, and upper middle income households and above still had financial mobility. Opportunity for some, distress for others. In that environment, a small idea born in a San Francisco apartment began to reshape global housing. In 2008, roommates Brian Chesky and Joe Gabbia, short on rent, put air mattresses on their floor during a design conference and called the service Air Bed and Breakfast.
We end up hosting three people, a 35-year-old woman from Boston, a 30-year-old from India, a 45-year-old father of five from Utah. But what ended up happening was we ended up becoming friends and we made enough money to pay our rent. At this point, we say, you know, we're ordinary guys. I bet you there's a lot of other ordinary people like us that want to make some extra money, meet cool people. I asked Joe, I said, well, who's the best engineer you know? Joe said, well, my old roommate Nate is. And so the three of us got together and we had a simple idea. What if you can book someone's home the way you could book a hotel anywhere in the world? And that's how it started.
It worked. With Nathan Blacharsik as a third co-founder, they built a simple website for bookings. Major events like the Democratic National Convention brought them their first real wave of demand. By March 2009, the company rebranded as Airbnb and began expanding from air mattresses to entire homes. With mentorship and funding from Y Combinator, the platform grew rapidly, not just as a tool for struggling tenants to earn supplemental income, but as a vehicle for homeowners and soon small rental property investors to monetize spare rooms, vacation properties, and even speculative purchases. Airbnb didn't just disrupt hotels, it helped normalize a new class of housing investment. Suddenly, it became easy and lucrative for higher earners to buy second and third homes and convert them into high-value short-term rentals. A technology meant to help people make rent had inadvertently opened a gate to asset accumulation for those who already had financial leverage. Today, Airbnb operates globally, connecting millions of hosts and guests, and playing a significant role in reshaping housing markets from the neighborhood level to global tourism economies. Another buyer that stepped into the wreckage came in a new form, corporate investors. What had been the heartbreak of families became a new opportunity for Wall Street. They moved on from MBS to private equity firms that began buying homes by the thousands. A private equity firm is an investment company that leverages others' money to buy stakes in private businesses or takes public companies private with one goal, extract a profit. Unlike publicly traded stock, private equity ownership is limited to specialized funds and partnerships that step in not just as investors, but as operators, reshaping companies from the inside. But the model comes with a cost. Private equity is often criticized for aggressive tactics, loading companies with debt, slashing jobs, and prioritizing short-term returns over long-term stability. And the fallout is increasingly visible. In the first quarter of 2025, 7 out of 10 corporate bankruptcies involving more than $1 billion in liabilities were tied to private equity-owned companies, even though the sector represents just 6.5% of the U.S. economy. The trend isn't new. In 2024, private equity-backed firms made up 11% of all bankruptcies and more than half of the nation's largest bankruptcies. By early 2025, companies across sectors, Forever 21, Prospect Medical Holdings, Red Lobster, Joann's, all collapsed or spiraled into distress after private equity ownership. It's a pattern. Concentrated control, aggressive restructuring, enormous debt, and when the model fails, the public absorbs the damage while the firm moves on. Blackstone, today the world's largest private equity firm, quickly became the most aggressive player. Founded in 1985 by Peter Peterson and Steven Schwarzman, both alumni of Lehman Brothers, the firm began as a mergers and acquisition boutique. Schwarzman supplied ambition. Peterson supplied political gravitas. Now remember that name, Peter Peterson, because we'll come back to him later in the series. Schwarzman's rise was meteoric. After graduating from Yale, where he and future President George W. Bush belonged to the secretive Skull and Bones Society, and earning his MBA at Harvard, he joined Lehman Brothers. By 31, he was running global mergers and acquisitions. When American Express absorbed Lehman in 1984, he walked away, joining Peterson to launch an investment company with $400,000 of their own money in seed capital. It would soon become one of the most powerful financial engines on Earth.
If there was something that was happening that was like an amazing opportunity, that we wanted to do that, we decided we'd only do it in two circumstances. The first is if we could hire somebody who was a 10 out of 10, because then we know we would crush it, because we wouldn't know that field. And the second is if that business generated intellectual capital, so it made our existing businesses much stronger. If it didn't meet those two tests, we wouldn't do it. And so we took that strategic plan and we mailed it to everybody. And nobody gave it. You know, it was amazing. And I thought it was a really good plan. By the way, it's 34 years later.
It was a really good plan.
We're still doing the same plan.
Yeah, it was a really good
plan. We've never changed. We just are executing the same thing. And we wait around until there's something really neat. So good, even I can't screw it up. So you have to pass up little things and only do really, really big things. So that was our plan, and you know it ends up now. You know, they have different names for this, intellectual capital production. This is like data. We've been doing this since 1985 because knowledge is power in finance. Everybody thinks the same, more or less. I mean, you all test well, you all go to good schools, you all get well trained. So how do you win the game? You have to have knowledge other people don't have. And to do that, you have to produce that knowledge, and then you have to figure out how do the pieces fit. You know, how do you see something in one area that tells you what's going to happen in another area? And if you have that, and you can mine that, and now they have names for this, data mining, okay? It's just information and seeing patterns,
yeah,
which lead you to other opportunities.
Blackstone's evolution mirrored the arc of modern finance. After advising on the 1987 merger of Shearson Lehman and E.F. Hutton, earning a $3.5 million fee, the firm entered private equity. Leveraged buyouts, once considered niche, became its core strategy. As Blackstone's power grew, so did its appetite. After the 1987 stock crash, the firm raised its first private equity fund. In the 1990s, it expanded into Europe and then real estate, buying chains like Days Inn and Super 8. Throughout the decade, it snapped up companies across sectors, from Six Flags to funeral homes, refining the model it would later scale globally. With massive success came stature and proximity to political influence. Schwarzman became one of Wall Street's most connected power players, a dealmaker, an advisor to presidents, globally connected, and a major donor across the political spectrum. At the height of his ascent, he lived in a setting almost symbolic of American wealth, 740 Park Avenue, the storied Upper East Side building long known as the most exclusive residence in New York. According to New York City real estate lore, whoever inherits the biggest penthouse at 740 inherits the throne of New York society itself. In 2000, Schwarzman bought it for around $30 million. The building itself was a monument to concentrated power. Its marble lobby, bronze medal chutes, and uniformed doormen were the backdrop to residents like John D. Rockefeller Jr., David Koch of Koch Industries, and Merrill Lynch CEO John Thain, a who's who of the elite. In 2011, filmmaker Alex Gibney's Park Avenue, Money, Power, and the American Dream revealed that 740 Park's residents donated more money to political campaigns than any other building in the country. these were the people shaping the policies that ultimately destabilized the economy, and then writing the rules for its reconstruction. Influence wasn't just translating into profit. It was becoming ownership of everything. By the early 2000s, Blackstone had become one of the only firms capable of executing multi-billion dollar deals in a bruised economy. In 2002, it raised a then-record $6.45 billion fund. It bought Houghton Mifflin for $1.28 billion. It expanded its hospitality holdings, acquiring Prime Hospitality, La Quinta Inns and Suites, and in one of the most infamous private equity deals in history, Hilton Hotels for $26 billion in 2007. This was the prelude to what would happen after 2008. When the housing market collapsed and millions of families lost their homes, Blackstone and firms like it didn't see tragedy. They saw inventory, deeply discounted, scattered, and ripe for consolidation. And they moved quickly, in a way ordinary Americans could not. The logic was best communicated by investor, chairman, and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett.
Equities are still cheap relative to any other asset class.
But they're not.
I would say the single family homes are cheap now, too.
You would?
Yeah, single family homes. But if I had a way of buying a couple hundred thousand single family homes and had a way of managing. The management is enormous. It's really a problem because they're one by one. They're not like apartment houses. So, but I would load up on them, and I would take mortgages out at very, very low rates. But if anybody is thinking about buying homes 5 years ago, they couldn't buy them fast enough because they thought they were going to go up, and now they don't buy them because they think they're going to go down, and interest rates are far lower. It's a way, in effect, to short the dollar because you can take a 30-year mortgage. And if it turns out your interest rate's too high next week, you refinance lower. And if it turns out it's too low, the other guy's stuck with it for 30 years. So it's a very attractive asset class now.
If you are a young individual investor at home and you have your choice between buying your first home or investing in stocks, where would you tell someone is the better bet?
If I thought I was going to live, if I knew where I was going to want to live the next 5 or 10 years, I would buy a home and I'd finance it with a 30-year mortgage. It's a terrific deal. And if I was an investor that was a handy type, which I'm not, and I could buy a couple of them at distressed prices and find renters, I think that's and again, take a 30-year mortgage. It's a leveraged way of owning a very cheap asset now. I think that's probably as attractive an investment as you can make.
One of the most consequential acquisitions in Blackstone's dominance came from a small Arizona firm called the Treehouse Group. Founded in 2005 by Dallas Tanner and partners, Treehouse began buying up distressed homes in Phoenix, a city leveled by the foreclosure wave and one of the earliest laboratories for turning owner-occupied houses into rental commodities. Between 2010 and 2011, they amassed roughly 1,000 homes. In 2012, Blackstone bought Treehouse and flooded it with cash for something unprecedented: Invitation Homes, a single-family rental empire that would eventually control more than 80,000 homes nationwide. The speed was staggering. Invitation Homes' first purchase closed in April 2012. Within a year, it had spent $4 billion acquiring 24,000 homes, instantly becoming the largest single-family landlord in the country. In Atlanta alone, the company bought more than 1,400 homes in a single deal. In Tampa Bay, it acquired 1,650 homes in under a year, and soon listed 85% of them at rents above the regional average. These purchases were calculated. Firms like Invitation Homes targeted, quote, strike zones, neighborhoods close to jobs, schools, and transit, but recently gutted by foreclosure. Their ideal renter was not the poor, but middle-class families making around $100,000 a year, people priced out of ownership, but still reliable enough to pay rising rents. In 2013, Invitation Homes went further and helped invent an entirely new financial product, single-family rental securities, or SFRs. Wall Street could now bundle suburban homes into bonds the same way it had bundled mortgages a decade earlier. The business model was brutally simple: rent the homes people had just lost back to them. By 2017, institutional investors owned nearly 1 in 10 single-family homes in some markets. Neighborhoods once built for community became revenue streams. Even as millions of Americans were evicted or underwater, Blackstone reported record profits. That year, Invitation Homes sold nearly $10 billion in SFR bonds. By 2018, the figure climbed to $15 billion. And in a historic move, Fannie Mae, long barred from financing companies that bought distressed homes, provided a $1 billion credit line to Invitation Homes. Affordable housing groups condemned the decision, arguing that a government agency created to support homeowners was now backing a corporate landlord that priced them out. In February 2017, Invitation Homes went public in one of the largest REIT IPOs in U.S. history. Months later, it merged with Starwood Waypoint, swelling its portfolio even further. Blackstone eventually exited in 2019, having transformed the company into a financial juggernaut. But for Invitation Homes, the acquisitions kept coming. In 2020, they partnered with Rockpoint Group to buy another $1 billion in homes across major metros. We'll explore the concept deeper in the next episode, but in 2021, Invitation Homes launched a joint venture with home building company PulteGroup to build 7,500 new houses specifically for the rental market. Entire neighborhoods constructed not for ownership, but for permanent tenancy.
Well, the fundamentals around housing are really favorable for companies like ours, whereas we don't have enough, you know, needed housing supply in the U.S. today, given the amount of demand that we're seeing real time. Our business today sits about 97.5% occupied. We're seeing a customer that continues to stay longer and longer with our business. And because of the dislocation between where home prices are, mortgage rates sit, and the availability of housing for lease, it's much more favorable to lease a home today than it would be to own. Somewhere between $1,200, $1,300 a month cheaper in our markets than it would be to own in those similar markets. And so that value proposition has played itself out very well for our company, evidenced by the numbers I shared with you. Continued really strong occupancy, really favorable rent growth, and a customer that's staying longer and longer.
This is Dallas Tanner, CEO of Invitation Homes, discussing market conditions during Nareit's REIT Week 2024 Investor Conference.
Lack of supply will be an issue. We're trying to build as much as we can. We're using our balance sheet to basically lean in and try to build with a number of different regional and national partners, new homes, new home communities. We currently have about 3,000 homes being constructed in one way, shape, or form, and somewhere in that process. I think another issue around the lack of supply will create challenges for flexibility. So if you have a lease or you own a home today, you're in a great spot. If you are looking for a home or looking for a lease today, there's less to choose from. So that will also put additional pressure on demand, which, you know, could increase, you know, or keep pricing elevated in housing. And I think lastly is regulatory. Markets and states and cities are looking at all these things differently. Some of it's political, some of it tends to be in line with what the needs or the wants for that market particularly are. In markets where housing is being approved at a much quicker pace, they've been able to deal with some of these supply issues. In markets where regulation has kept private capital from creating new housing units, it's added to sort of the shortage and the issues that you find in those markets. So I think those are sort of the big picture kind of macros that will, I think, impact housing or say over the next year or two.
All of this activity reshaped the market, even in areas where corporate landlords owned only 10 to 25% of rental homes. Their influence was outsized. They bought properties in cash, often above asking price, setting new comparable sales values that pushed appraisals and future prices higher. What looked like modest ownership levels produced enormous upward pressure. The incentives were clear: minimize repair costs, maximize rents, and issue more bonds. And the effects were harmful for communities. A 2016 Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta study found Wall Street landlords evicted tenants at far higher rates than mom-and-pop owners. 15% at Invitation Homes, 30% at Starwood Waypoint. Between individual rental property investors and Wall Street's private equity giants stood another kind of buyer, politically connected real estate empires like Jared Kushner's. Kushner, son-in-law to Donald Trump and a senior advisor in his administration, took over Kushner Companies after his father, Charles Kushner, was convicted in 2005 on 18 counts including tax evasion, illegal campaign contributions, and witness tampering. He was later pardoned by Trump in 2020. Kushner Companies had long dominated the New Jersey rental market, but in the 2010s, it tapped the EB-5 visa program to fuel a boom in luxury development. The program is a method for eligible immigrant investors to become lawful permanent residents by investing substantial capital to finance a U.S. business. At the same time, the company expanded its holdings in low-income rentals, drawing scrutiny for aggressive, eviction-heavy tactics. In 2017, Bloomberg reported the firm was in a distressed situation. That same year, a ProPublica investigation revealed Kushner Companies had filed hundreds of eviction suits in Baltimore, often against tenants who had already moved out or never owed the amounts claimed. Bloomberg's report also identified the company was scrambling to secure foreign investment to stabilize its finances. Legal and ethical questions followed. In December 2017, federal prosecutors subpoenaed Deutsche Bank records tied to Kushner Companies. Later in 2019, the New York Times revealed that anti-money laundering specialists inside the bank flagged suspicious transactions involving entities linked to Jared Kushner, including transfers to Russian individuals, but senior executives rejected filing the reports. Separately, in 2018, The Times also reported that a private equity firm, Apollo Global Management, lent $184 million to Kushner Companies, and banking giant Citigroup lent Kushner Companies and one of its partners $325 million. This is Jesse Drucker, one of the investigative reporters that broke the story with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
Right. So there's two different loans that we wrote about. One of them is from Apollo, which is a big private equity firm. And one of the founders of Apollo, an executive there, is a guy named Josh Harris, who over the course of the year last year had a number of meetings with the White House, including meetings with Jared Kushner, including meetings about a possible job with the administration. Now, he didn't get a job with the administration, but in November of last year, Kushner Companies got a $184 million loan from Apollo. And, you know, by the standards of both Apollo and Kushner Companies, that is a very sizable loan. It's basically triple the size of the average loan that Apollo's real estate group gives out. And it's one of the biggest loans that Kushner Companies received all of last year. And it was for an office building in Chicago in which Jared Kushner remains invested.
So, all that talk of Jared Kushner divesting himself or separating himself from his family's company, he is still personally invested in that building?
Yeah, so I think, you know, this is kind of a common misconception, right? So when Jared Kushner took the job with the Trump administration last year, he stepped down from his position as chief executive officer of the company. But he only divested a very small portion of his ownership stake in the company. He sold some portions of his stake in the company to a trust controlled by his mother and benefiting his siblings. But for the most part, he is still very heavily invested in Kushner Companies, including invested in the building in Chicago that was refinanced with the loan from Apollo, and also invested in a series of buildings in Brooklyn that we haven't talked about yet, which received a $325 million loan from Citigroup last year. And that's significant because that loan took place shortly after a White House meeting between Jared Kushner and the CEO of Citigroup. So, you know, in both instances, you're seeing Jared Kushner meeting with executives in the White House, and then sometime after those meetings, the companies that those executives work for, run, or help to run are giving very sizable mortgages to his company.
And in 2020, Kushner companies received a near-record $786 million in loans from government-sponsored Freddie Mac, with unusually favorable terms, according to ProPublica and WNYC. That money helped Kushner buy thousands of apartments in Maryland and Virginia, raising conflict of interest alarms given his position in the White House. This was not an isolated story. It was a symbol of what the housing market had become, a system where proximity to power, leverage, and influence increasingly determined who could own and who could be owned by the market. The result wasn't just economic displacement, it was psychological, a slow unraveling of faith that a home could be a stable ground again. After 2008, the Federal Reserve kept interest rates near zero for nearly a decade. But cheap money didn't flow to workers, it flowed to investors. Average Americans couldn't compete with all-cash bids, algorithmic buying, or private equity capital. Between 2010 and 2020, corporations spent $6 trillion on stock buybacks. Wages barely moved. Economists called it financialization, the transformation of everyday necessities, including housing, into financial assets. Shelter wasn't a home. It was a return on investment, and the wealthiest 1% captured nearly all of the post-recession income gains. The 2008 collapse didn't just reshape the economy, it remade the political ecosystem that governed it. In Washington, Wall Street's influence only tightened. Senator Chuck Schumer, now majority leader, built his career courting the financial industry. They actually call him Wall Street Chuck on Capitol Hill. Though he once warned that repealing Glass-Steagall would turn banks into casinos, by 1999, he supported its repeal. Over decades, he fought off oversight measures, protected credit rating agencies, and became one of the largest recipients of financial sector donations in Congress. In late 2007, Congress made its first serious attempt to close the carried interest loophole, H.R. 2834, introduced by Representative Sander Levin, would have taxed fund managers' compensation as ordinary income rather than capital gains, a change that the Joint Committee on Taxation estimated would raise nearly $50 billion over 10 years and curb offshore tax shifting. The House approved it, but when the reform reached the Senate, Wall Street pushed back hard. Donations to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee surged. The day before the key Senate vote, private equity executive Frederick Eisman cut a $28,500 check. Senator Hillary Clinton declined to co-sponsor the bill. Senator Chuck Schumer insisted that any reform also apply to real estate and venture capital, a move that broadened opposition and helped stall the effort. In the end, the carried interest provision was stripped out. The loophole survived. The day after the vote, hedge fund manager John Paulson sent another $25,000. The money had spoken. After the 2008 collapse, however, there was no escaping some level of reform, which complicated Schumer's relationship with Wall Street.
And as for donors, I mean, you have to call the shots where they see them, where you see them. And you're not going to make everybody happy, but you have to be guided by what I like to call an internal gyroscope. What's the right thing to do here? And there are some on the right who say don't do anything or do very little. That would let the crisis happen again, and the same problems we have today would repeat themselves. There are some on the left who just want to be vindictive, nasty, punitive. Let's just take out a knife and cut these guys. That's not going to accomplish anything. But if you're smart about this, you can come up with reform that will prevent this from happening again, will make New York and Wall Street stronger. And I have to tell you, lots of the smart people on Wall Street and the forward-thinking people on Wall Street agree with it.
Meanwhile, lobbyists like the notorious Jack Abramoff exploited one of Washington's greatest weaknesses: thinly staffed congressional offices, overwhelmed by legislation they didn't have the capacity to write. Corporations didn't just influence policy. They literally authored it, and Abramoff was their maestro.
When we would become friendly with an office, and they were important to us, and the chief of staff was a competent person, I would say, or my staff would say to him or her at some point, you know, when you're done working on the Hill, we'd very much like you to consider coming to work for us. Now, the moment I said that to them, or any of our staff said that to them, that was it. We owned them. And what does that mean? Every request from our office, every request of our clients, everything that we want, they're going to do. And not only that, they're going to think of things we can't think of to do.
During the Bush years, he became one of the most powerful lobbyists in the Capitol, a political operative who understood that access was currency. In 2001, he was appointed to the Bush administration's transition advisory team for the Department of the Interior, where he quickly forged a close relationship with incoming Deputy Secretary J. Stephen Griles, a connection that would later sit at the center of federal corruption probes. A draft report by the House Government Reform Committee revealed just how far Abramoff's reach extended.
We probably had very strong influence in 100 offices at a time.
Come on.
No.
100 offices?
In those days, I would view that as a failure, because at least 335 offices that we didn't have strong influence in.
There, he's referring to congressional offices that he owned. Within the White House, his billing records and emails documented 485 contacts with White House officials over just 3 years, 10 with Karl Rove alone, President Bush's top political advisor. Of those interactions, 345 were in-person meetings, 70 were phone calls, and 69 were emails. This wasn't just lobbying, it was saturation. An industrial-scale presence designed to shape policy before the public even knew what was being drafted. Abramoff's empire collapsed in 2005 when investigators uncovered a sprawling scheme involving Native American tribes seeking to develop casino projects. Abramoff and his partner Michael Scanlon collected more than $85 million in fees, grossly overbilling their clients while secretly sabotaging them, lobbying against the very tribes they represented to force them into paying more. The corruption spread outward. Illegal gifts, campaign contributions, and favors traded for legislative action. Representative Bob Ney of Ohio, aides to Majority Leader Tom DeLay, and a constellation of congressional staffers were implicated. By 2006, Abramoff pleaded guilty to mail fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials. He received a 6-year federal sentence. In total, 21 people, including White House officials Griles and David Safavia, were convicted or pleaded guilty. Abramoff never touched housing policy, but his scandal exposed a government increasingly outsourced to private interests, where corporations could write the rules meant to restrain them. That same culture of deregulation, influence, and policymaking for profit helped create the environment where predatory lending flourished and the housing market became ripe for exploitation. Then came Citizens United v. FEC, the 2010 Supreme Court 5-4 decision that declared corporations could spend unlimited money on political speech. The majority opinion was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote,
"Political speech is indispensable to democracy, which is no less true because the speech comes from a corporation."
In the dissenting opinion by Justice John Paul Stevens, he argued that the majority ruling
"threatens to undermine the integrity of elected institutions across the nation. The path it has taken to reach its outcome will, I fear, do damage to this institution. A democracy cannot function effectively when its constituent members believe laws are being bought and sold."
In practice, Citizens United meant something simple and devastating. The loudest voice in a democracy would belong to whoever could spend the most. The impact was immediate. during the 2008 election cycle, the last before the ruling, outside spending totaled about $574 million. By 2012, it had more than doubled to nearly $1.3 billion. By 2020, it hit $3.3 billion, and by 2024, approached $4.5 billion, most of it funneled through super PACs. Corporate money didn't just enter politics, it drowned it. And as capital surged into Washington, housing, once understood as the bedrock of American stability, became just another asset class. By the early 2010s, homeownership slipped from 67% to 65% and kept falling. Millions of Americans, especially millennials, were locked out entirely. Rents soared. Institutional landlords tightened their grip. Homes were bought sight unseen by investors. Sometimes not even by humans, but by algorithms. The American dream, work hard, buy a home, build a life, collapsed. Upward mobility stalled. The Great Recession had been sold as a freak accident of financial engineering, but the longer we looked, the clearer the truth became. It was the predictable outcome of decades of policy decisions that privileged capital over community, speculation over stability. The crisis didn't end, it morphed. And unless we confront the financial machinery and corrupted politics that created it, the next collapse isn't hypothetical, it's scheduled. And in that catastrophe, the divide will be expansive. The 2008 crash should have been a reckoning, a warning about deregulation, concentrated power, and markets left to govern themselves. Instead, it became a blueprint. The same institutions rescued with public money began buying the very homes families had lost, transforming entire neighborhoods into corporate portfolios. And from those acquisitions emerged a new model, built to rent. Subdivisions built not for ownership, but for permanent tenancy. Privatization seeped into everything. Housing, infrastructure, even farmland. Airbnb turned spare rooms and entire neighborhoods into investment strategies. Developers rebranded corporate subdivisions as communities. Investors bought the soil beneath the country's food supply. And so, a question that haunted the nation a century ago rose again. What becomes of the public good when everything, every need, every home, every acre, is for sale? But this time, we didn't resist. Decades of messaging had trained us to admire wealth, to shield the powerful, and to believe, often against all evidence, that with enough grit or luck, we might someday join them. In the land of the free, everything has a price, and life itself will cost you something. In the next episode, we'll trace the rise of the privatization movement, we'll unpack how build-to-rent communities grew from foreclosure auctions into billion-dollar assets, and how the same logic is reshaping our neighborhoods and our farmlands. Not everything should run like a business. And when we forget that, the cost isn't just economic, it's human. Next time on Built to Divide.
We believe that there's a need for trillions of dollars investing in infrastructure related to our power grids, AI, the whole digitization of an economy.
Thanks for listening. Built to Divide is presented by Lines, my architecture and creative studio. This podcast is produced in collaboration with Gable Media. If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend and rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find it. And if you're looking for similar content, Built to Divide is part of the Gable Media Network, where you can find even more like this. Visit GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, video clips, and content that went into this episode, you can visit me at lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.
This is the White House as seen from the South Lawn. We're in the state dining room, on the left of the screen, hidden behind the trees. There are three rooms which serve as reception rooms for the smaller official functions of the White House. The Red Room. Behind these walls, after the death of Willie Lincoln, Mrs. Lincoln consulted mediums and prevailed upon her husband to attend one seance. The Blue Room. Until recent times, this was the room where presidents received the credentials of foreign ambassadors to the United States. The Green Room. This used to be the dining room, and here Jefferson gave his famous dinners and introduced such exotic foods as macaroni, waffles, and ice cream to the United States.